The son of two immigrants, Sergio Troncoso grew up in a colonia, an informal neighborhood of El Paso. Since then, he's gone on to write 5 books and win a Fulbright. He now teaches at the Yale Writers Conference. Every summer, he visits Kansas City to teach creative writing at the George Caleb Bingham Academy for the Arts. We'll talk with Sergio about the influence of teachers, the value of community, and the importance of giving back. And Sergio Troncoso, welcome. So good to have you here.
Thank you, Steve. I love coming to Independence. It's one of my favorite places to come every year.
That's great. And joining him is Ashton Harris. He's a high school student currently attending the Bingham Academy out in Independence. And Ashton, nice to have you too. Welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you for having me, sir.
Well, Sergio, you teach at the Academy as a favor to an old teacher. Who is the teacher and what influence did they have in your education?
Well, it was Ron Clemens, and his wife Molly Clemens is now the director of the program, so I know both of them very well. But I met Mr. Clemens back in New Jersey when he was running a program called the Blair Summer School for Journalism as a high school student from El Paso, from very much of a poor background. I won a scholarship from Gannett to spend summers in New Jersey learning to write, become a better newspaper writer. And Mr. Clemens, through another teacher, Pearl Crouch, got me into the program. And
It lit you up.
Yeah, and he was great. You know, that's how I got to know him originally. And then when I became a writer, he invited me to the program here.
Yeah. You know, you've spoken in past interviews about returning to your community of Isleta and speaking at El Paso high schools to share what you've learned. Why is it important for you to pay it forward like this ultimately?
Because I was that poor kid on the Mexican border once, and I was this fat kid who loved to read. And there are other kids like that right now on the border. My brother is a high school principal on the border, and I have another brother who's a high school English teacher. So I go back home to El Paso every year, several times a year. And it's important for me to spread this love of reading, of literature, of writing to these kids who sometimes often are not exposed to that, and to tell their stories, because too often what they're reading in the high school has very little relevance to, you know, to their lives.
And how do you change that?
Well, you change it one book at a time. Mm-hmm. I think you change it by talking to people like the Texas Library Association. You change it by writing a good story that wins national prizes, that suddenly opens a door and the book gets into libraries. And, you know, I've been an evangelist for encouraging reading, certainly not just along the border, but to any community that comes from an impoverished status that perhaps might get overlooked by people.
Now, let's talk about the Academy itself. I'm curious about it. Ashton, tell us about the program and how it's helping you as a burgeoning writer.
Well, it really it's saved my writing. Before I came to GCB, I was writing on my own, and I'd never really gotten much feedback from anyone. And GCB is a they give you prompts that you can work with, and you can tinker with ideas.
GCB, George Caleb Bingham Academy.
Sorry, that's how I refer to
your
it.
Your cool colloquial phrase there.
Uh-huh. Yeah. It's a great chance to sit down and make friends, and you get feedback from your friends and from the teachers as well. And there's no other program like it because in public schools, you don't get that kind of attention. I mean, it's 4 hours every day during the week with not only your friends who can critique your writing as well, but two teachers as well.
What year in high school are you?
I just graduated last May, sir.
Why writing? I mean, why are you so hooked? It sounds like you are.
Yes, I am absolutely hooked on writing. I've loved books since I was 10. Started with Harry Potter, and it's
never stopped.
Oh, yeah. Harry Potter.
I wonder how many kids across the country were hooked onto reading or writing by those books.
Oh, yeah. I can't even imagine how many. But, and it's just, it's something fun, it's therapeutic, and you can change lives with writing, I think.
How do you want to change lives with your writing? What do you want to do?
I just really want to give hope to people around the world that there is a better way to live, you know, together. There's a lot of strife out there, and there's a lot of war and anguish, and I just want to spread peace, really, to kids that and let them know that there is someone out there that cares for you and that there is someone out there that loves you, and you might not see it right now, but I just want to spread that belief that someone does care about you.
You live in Independence?
Yes, sir.
And what kind of backdrop does that provide you as a young man who wants to be a writer someday? How rich of material is that for you going forward?
Well, I grew up, I'm 18, almost 19. I grew up my first 17 years in Belton, Missouri, and that was a very rich environment as well. Rich being one way to put it.
Maybe not literally in some ways.
Well, yeah. No, not at all. And it was it's very interesting to look at people around you as characters because, I mean, if you think about it, I mean, you yourself are a character in your own story, and you might be someone else's antagonist or their helping character or that one person that they meet you once in their life and you could, through some small act, you change their life forever.
Yeah.
And just that thought right there kind of sparked my idea that, I mean, if I can touch someone's life in some small way and change someone's life forever, I mean, imagine what I could do if I wrote a book, you know?
Sergio, you got a winner here, it sounds like.
He's, you know, Ashton is a great student.
Yeah.
And I love teaching kids like him here in Independence, you know, because they're so focused. And we work on everything from line editing. So we literally go through line by line, picking out words that are not necessary, for example, taking them out. So it's very much of a, you know, person-to-person, line-by-line edit and instruction. And I believe, you know, I'm certainly Aristotelian. I believe you learn by doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you want to be an editor, you have to begin with editing your own work.
That. Yeah, so. I teach writing at UMKC, and I also have been a journalist for 30 years, and I know exactly what you're talking about, going through things line-by-line, picking out the extra words and getting rid of them, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah, they clutter stuff up, don't they?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, Sergio, you had a high school teacher yourself who took you to writing competitions and, you know, he pushed you to grow as a writer. How do these influences, whether a mentor or something like the Bingham Academy, how do all those things shape future writers?
Well, you know, I had Pearl Crouch. Mm-hmm. She was a tremendous teacher and a friend of Mr. Clemens. And what she was doing at Isleta High School, in this high school right about a half a mile from the border, I don't know. She was a tough lady who expected so much from me. I would turn in essays or articles for the newspaper, and she would give them back to me and said, this is not good enough for you. You can rewrite them. And I also wanted to turn the newspaper into a real paper, mm-hmm. not just write about pep rally announcements and the sort of official kind of propaganda piece. I actually started writing in the newspaper about you know, sex and drugs in school. About one of the stories I wrote about was an illegal immigrant that had gotten beat up behind our high school,
mm-hmm.
and that officer eventually ended up being fired. But what happened is when I started writing these real articles in the newspaper as a high schooler, people wanted to read the paper. The paper became something real. A reportage of what was going on in the high school and not a propaganda piece. And mm-hmm. Pearl Crouch always wanted that kind of real newspaper for high schoolers.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember once I wrote an article on a little bit of embezzlement that mm-hmm. had happened where the student council had gotten money from car washes and cupcake sales and all of that for a trip.
Mm-hmm.
And the money was missing. Mm. And apparently a secretary had absconded with the money.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote about it, of course. I didn't name names, but I said, this happened. The money is missing. And the principal of Isleta High School came in and said, you know, what do you think you're doing? You know, you're printing this. And Pearl Crouch defended me. Said, just name anywhere on this newspaper article. Name anything that's false.
Mm.
And every fact was true. And he said, the problem is you just don't like that my editor wrote about it.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, why don't you go take care of your office and the people who are taking the students' money rather than coming to criticize my editor? And so...
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so I learned that you write about real things. You write about what matters. You don't write about the prettified things because that's what people care about. And, of course, I won state awards and suddenly people... started paying attention to my writing.
Ashton, is Sergio pushing you as hard as his mentor used to push him?
I'm not sure about that. I remember last year we talked about one of my pieces that I did, and there are so many grammatical errors there. Oh my gosh. And that was frustrating because I looked at it beforehand and I'm like, oh, this looks fine. And then after our conversation,
I've
been there before. This is terrible.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, no, but Ashton is a very good writer, I have to say. No, and you know, nobody's ever perfect. You always can improve.
You know, it strikes me that making art, you know, especially writing, is very much a solitary exercise. But community is a big theme here, Sergio. What is the significance of building a community of artists, whether at the Bingham Academy or anywhere else for that matter?
We were just talking about that today in class. And I told the high school kid at the George Caleb Bingham Academy, I said, what you want to do after the summer is link with each other. And here's a writing exercise that you can continue every month, and a 1,000-word piece with a prompt. You choose a noun, and somebody chooses a noun, and you start building a community of people comparing each other's work.
And that's important. Why?
Because you don't feel alone.
Mm-hmm.
You're writing alone, yet after a certain amount of time, you're actually sharing the work and comparing how you can do better. And you also get a little sense of fun competition. You start comparing these 1,000-word pieces. And it's like, as I told them, lifting weights for writers. And then whoever wins that competition at the end of the month gets to choose the next prompt. And I do it with writers at my level all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And you create a community of people interested in writing, interested in experimenting with writing, and you create your own built-in audience. When you have that group of friends waiting for your piece, you get it done.
Ashton, do you guys think you'll do that going forward, leaving the academy?
Sergio actually presented that idea to us last year, and I was part of the George Caleb Bingham Academy last year as well, and he presented us with that idea, and we made a Facebook group of everyone that was in the class, and we did do that throughout the year, and it was very fun. It was very, very interesting.
Ashton, can you see yourself teaching someday?
That's actually what I want to do. Sergio and I were talking about where I'm going since I've graduated. And I'm
where are you going?
Blue River, actually, which is where the...
The community college.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yep. And that's actually where the program is held. And so I'm going down to Blue River and then on to UCM. Sorry. And and UCM to...
University of Central Missouri.
Yes.
Down in Warrensburg, right?
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, good for you.
And I'm going to hope to major in English education. So.
Oh, there you go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, the writing side of the academy culminates in a literary journal. Do you know who's going to be contributing to that yet? Where does that stand?
Well, you know, Ashton is the editor of the journal this year. So I'm sure he can give us what's happening.
How's that shaping up?
It's turning out pretty well. So every year, GCB, George Caleb Bingham Academy, has a theme that we try to revolve the program around, the plays, the music, the art pieces, and especially our writing. And so this year, the theme is 100 years ago. And as some people know, 100 years ago, World War One started. And so we're not focusing strictly on the war, but we kind of are. But we're looking at the time period between 1914 to the early 20s. And we're just looking at the heart of the time back then and what it was like and what people were facing out in the trenches and what the home front was like. And we're putting it all in a magazine, and we've got original artwork by the art students, and we went and visited the National World War One Museum, and that was a lot of fun, and so it's all coming together.
You strike me as a young man who doesn't let a whole lot get in his way. Am I seeing that right?
I think you are, sir.
Yeah,
yes.
I think I'm seeing that right. We're visiting this morning, if you're just joining us, with author Sergio Troncoso and one of his students, Ashton Harris, who are taking part at the Bingham Academy, a writing program there this summer. You know, you talk, Sergio, in a lot of your work about the immigrant value of hard work. How does that connect to what you're doing in Independence? How does that connect to the writing you do all the time?
Well, you know, I teach my young writers like Ashton that to get a book done, it takes sacrifice beyond what you can imagine.
Yeah,
working
I get that.
At 1 in the morning, at 2 in the morning. It works Saturdays and Sundays. There is no 40-hour kind of job.
Right, right.
And it takes that focus and that discipline. When other people may not be working, you should be working to produce another work. Don't wait for an essay or a story to get published. Produce another one as you're finishing one of them.
Yeah, how does the immigrant experience relate to that hard work?
You know, I mean, I grew up you know, with very little. And my parents said, there's no tired in my house. I was doing construction work after every day after I finished grade school and in high school as well. And every summer I worked. And it taught me that value of focus, of stamina, of just working beyond exhaustion. And I think that kind of values of that hard work and focus that I learned from my parents, I've tried to translate to my own kids in New York City. And I, you know, they call me the toughest dad on the Upper West Side. And when they didn't have homework, I gave them homework.
Oh, really?
When in the summer, when their friends were messing around and just doing nothing, they either took extra classes or they, you know, they did some of the homework and math homework that I would create for them.
Mm-hmm.
And they worked very hard. And I have a kid at Yale, and Aaron, for example, you know, scored a 2400 on his SAT.
Wow.
It wasn't magic. Mm-hmm. It was they learned to work hard. And I'm telling them that the values of New York City kids, and could be some kids in Missouri, but I know New York better, they're a little soft. They don't know how to work really, really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And I've tried to teach those immigrant values I learned in Isleta and on the border from my parents, who began with nothing and slowly rose up with this backbreaking work in New York City with kids who have much more than I ever did.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, same thing with Mike. I have an old younger son, Isaac, that is a, you know, a little bit younger than Ashton. Same thing. You know, teach them that focus and that drive. And I tell them you don't want to be a writer. You want to do something else, that's fine. But I want you to be the best. Mm-hmm. And I want you to be excellent. And how you get to be excellent is by doing more than the next person here. And that's what I try to teach them.
You know, I wanted to ask you about some of your recent work, because you were the co-editor of a book, Our Lost Border, Essays on Life Amid the Narco Violence, that came out last year. In the introduction to the book, you wrote this, and you're speaking of the border, Sergio. What the recent drug violence has undermined and even destroyed is this constant dialogue between people, as well as their creation of a borderland easily navigable by those creative and intrepid enough to live in this in-between. You mean what exactly when you talk about this in-between?
Well, for example, when I grew up in Isleta in El Paso, every week we would go have dinner in Mexico. Mexico, Juarez, and El Paso are so close, you can go to lunch in one city and come back before, you know, but before you have to. And we had cousins on both sides. We had family on both sides. And it teaches you that there's another country right next to you, and it's really one city divided by a small river. The Rio Grande is not so grande. Mm-hmm. It's actually quite small, like a little canal. And this bicultural, bilingual, binational life ended after 2008, after the drug violence really skyrocketed. And my parents, who grew up in Juarez, stopped going to Juarez. It was too dangerous. El Paso is very safe, but Juarez was not. Juarez was worse than probably one of the worst places in Syria. And I think it really rent this community in two in a way that it hadn't been before.
It used to be one. It became two distinct cities.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you know, the border wall also was being created. And so I wanted to write about this life that had existed before 2008, this going back and forth, these people who would switch from Spanish to English and back, and people who lived in between two cultures, two nations, even two languages, and became perfectly bilingual, just like I did, and what was lost, and really what we hope to get back now that the violence is ebbing, and people are starting to go back to Juarez.
Is the violence ebbing?
Yeah, I think 2010, I think, was the apex of the violence. There used to be, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, something like 3,000 murders in Juarez in 1 year, and now we're down to 400 or 500, I think.
Hmm.
It's still a lot. It's still as much as New York City, whereas Juarez is a fraction of the size, about 1.5 million. New York City is about 8 million. But it's much better than it was before. And El Paso, which, just to give you a sense, has 800,000 people and has 20, 30 murders a year. It's usually the the least violent city in the country other than San Jose.
Really?
Yeah. Crosses over the border. There's a big military presence in El Paso. Mm-hmm. Fort Bliss has tens of thousands of soldiers, and it just never crossed the border.
The violence is ebbing. Why?
Maybe they killed too many people. Maybe it's exhaustion. I think the government, the New Mexican government, has stopped the drug war, this outlaw drug war that began the violence. It could be they're making these accommodations that they used to make before, which is just don't kill people and allow the drug flow to go through. And you know, the other reality is we in the United States bear some responsibility for this war. You know, about
in the sense that
3/4 of the drugs purchased from the cartels are purchased in the United States, in places like Yale and Harvard and University of Missouri and so many other places. Mm-hmm. So they're fighting for our money, for the billions that we give them by purchasing these drugs. And I tell my kids that, by the way, I'm very blunt. I said, if you do drugs, you're helping to kill Mexicans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and for them it's very personal because it's not an abstraction. It's their family. It's their grandparents.
You talk about these two cultures in El Paso and Juarez. There's also, you write, essentially a third culture that's developed along the border. How so?
It's this culture that is not allied to Mexico City and not necessarily allied to Washington, D.C. It's this culture of people like my best friend Jeff Jenkins, at blonde and blue-eyed, who's perfectly bilingual and has a Mexican girlfriend. And that's typical in the El Paso and Juarez area. In Juarez, they're listening to the Dallas Cowboys. They're Mexican. They love American culture, yet they're Mexican, and they know English very well. And on the other side, in El Paso, people who don't think as Latinos or Mexicans and some other that they hate, but no, they're my brother, they're my cousin, I intermarried, and that's normal. And so you create this third culture of people going in between, people who are not seeing this, this other group as separate from them. And it bugs as much, you know, Washington, D.C. as it bugs Mexico City,
mm-hmm.
because the Mexicans along the border are seen as very Americanized from Mexico City's eyes. And then the Americans on the Mexican border are seen as a little bit too Mexicanized.
That's interesting.
By the interior parts of the U.S.
Author Jorge Troncoso is our guest. You know, you write in this book, Our Lost Border, the level of violence along the border, so much of it is just absolutely breathtaking. In one essay by Jose Skinner, he writes of a woman in Jasmine's hair salon who's waiting to get her hair done, complains about organized crime. And then she says, I wish a guerrilla army would rise up and kill all the mafiosos. And a man who's in the chair at the time getting a haircut hears this, waits until his haircut is finished, then stands up, pulls out a handgun, and orders the barber to cut off all the woman's hair who made the remark, or he said he's going to kill her. Just amazing.
It is. I mean, and it's shocking to see this kind of violence along the border. And, you know, I hope, you know, we've turned the corner and it's changed.
It sounds like you're confident that we have.
I think so. I mean, it's only because nobody wants it. Nobody can live like that.
Yeah.
When the society is so violent, you know, even the poor people cannot have peace. Even on both sides of the border, there's no winners, and it just creates an awful society that people are trying to get away from.
Jose Skinner also writes about of the story of a grandfather who's kidnapped for ransom. The grandfather's family pitches in to save him, but that's not enough. So the bad guys demand titles and deeds of the grandfather's land, which he's so proud of, which the man has to fork over. And there's also a sense of robberies never being reported because the police won't do anything anyway. It sounds absolutely, you know, crazed.
It is.
You just can't believe as you read some of these things.
Right. And the issue that maybe people here in the Midwest might not appreciate is that a lowly Mexican cop earning $20,000 a year is easily bought off. And they will say, say you're earning 20, I'll give you 40,000 in cash to look the other way, or I kill you. So what do you think you're
going
to do?
Well, given those choices, where
right.
are you going here?
Right. Yeah. And by the way, FBI agents on the U.S. side have been corrupted, mm-hmm. you know, and a couple of were prosecuted. So if they can corrupt FBI agents, you know, think of a guy earning $15,000, you know, in a little town in Chihuahua. And so it's billions sloshing around the border. And that's the kind of money that they have.
Now, in this book, Our Lost Border, you write an essay titled A World Between Two Worlds. And you talk about growing up in these two worlds of El Paso and Juarez on the Mexico side. I wonder if you would describe the barbershop, Los Hermanos Mesa, in Juarez, and why that place was important to you. Because this barbershop represented the best of the border. And then I wonder if you would describe something else entirely, and that's the story of Chavita and Cafe Miro.
Okay. Well, this barbershop, Los Hermanos...
I love the way you describe this place, by the way. It was just great.
Yeah, Los Hermanos Mesa was where I got my haircut as a grade schooler for about a decade. My father's favorite place.
It had been there for four generations, I think.
For four generations. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And my father loved going back to get his haircut there. Everybody knew him. Whereas in El Paso, he felt a little bit out of place. You know, he didn't fit in. When he went back to this barbershop in Juarez, Mexico, everyone greeted him by name, and he was very happy to be there. And people were very respectful of him. And I remember Nati, the chief barber, would always get down on one knee when we would walk in. We were kids, and he would talk to us eye to eye. You know, a very focused...
And shake your hand.
And shake our hand. Very mm-hmm. sort of genteel, almost old world, 1950s yeah. kind of view. And I loved this barbershop. And
you always wanted him to cut your hair, too.
Exactly, because mm-hmm. he would talk to you mm-hmm. rather than, you know, make fun of you or kind of, you know, trick you. He had an older brother who was a big trickster. And so I always wanted Nati because Nati was serious, and I like having serious discussions with Nati.
Yeah.
And so the milieu of this barbershop just had so much, it taught me so much about Mexico or what Mexico could be. In the best form, and that's why my father loved going there, because he really felt like this is where he belonged, in this barbershop with these people who respected him and understood him and gave him the same level of respect that he gave others.
That's such a great memory.
Yeah, it is.
You compared the barbershop to the bar in Ernest Hemingway's A Clean, Well-Lighted Place. So am I recalling that correctly?
Absolutely. No,
I thought it was a great analogy there.
Great,
you know?
Great memory. But it's a place where you feel warm inside, where you know you belong, where you can stay as long as you want. And it's more than just a barbershop. It's a place where you just fit.
Yeah.
And the sun is coming through, and you're waiting for your hair to get cut. And you just feel almost like a cleansing. And mm-hmm. it's just a haircut, really. You know, but it was a great place. And my cousin Chavita
and Cafe Miro, and that story is also on the opposite end of the scale here.
Chavita was this cousin, and that's a true story in this collection. He had come from Guadalajara, and he located himself in Juarez, and he was this guy, this cousin of mine, who lived on both sides. He had a business in El Paso, and then he would also opened up a bar called Cafe Miro in Juarez. And he would have a truck. He would drive, do his work in Cafe Miro at night. Then he would come on a bike and put it in the back of the truck and cross over the border and then get in another truck and go to his business in El Paso. And all the border agents knew him. He was an American citizen.
He did that because the lines would get so long.
Exactly. And so he could
walk. At
the border
crossing. He could expedite it. Yeah.
Exactly. He could walk faster across the bridge than to drive through. So he was doing this every day, literally crossing the border every day. And that was typical of El Paso Juarez before 2008. Mm-hmm. And so what happened, of course, after 2008 is that he also started these music festivals. A huge music festival started first with 3,000-4,000 people. He wanted to bring music to Juarez, and he brought in bands that the young Juarez teenagers would love. And then suddenly the narcos knew that they had a way to distribute drugs. they approached him at Café Miró, and they talked to the manager there. And I have a scene where I talk about how they talked to the manager. And this guy he'd never seen before says, give this to the owner. And it described what they wanted him to do, how much money they would pay him for security services. Mm-hmm. He had no choice but to pay them. And then they also said, these are how much drugs you're going to sell at these music festivals you've created. And Chavita said, you know, I'm not going to do this. He first called him and he argued again. He told him, you know, who the heck are you telling me what to do? And then they said, well, if you don't do what, you know, we know where you bank. We know where you live.
Yeah, that was just.
We know, they knew we know where you are. Him. Exactly. Yeah. And if you don't do it, we're going to kill you.
And his reaction was
in
heart
stopping. Right. In about 48 hours or so, I think it was two days or so, he closed Café Miró.
Fired all the staff.
He fired all the staff. He put everything in a warehouse, and he left from Juarez to El Paso. And all of the entrepreneurship, the festivals, all of what he had created over the years stopped because he said, I had two kids. They're under 10 years old. And
that's what mattered. I had no choice but really to look that way.
Right. And leave because I didn't want my family harmed. Mm-hmm. And so I think that kind of human capital and the ingenuity of what he was doing was all lost. And I think I've talked to him recently, and I think he's thinking of going back. So in my mind, he thinks it's safe enough to perhaps try again.
So our story is ending on something of a happy note here. That it sounds like Juarez is becoming a more inhabitable place, a more civilized place, and life may be continuing in a more in a better way.
We hope so. I mean, I think it is definitely improving, and you stifle creativity and you kill so many dreams when you have this kind of violence.
Yeah.
And I think that's what you saw in Juarez.
Sergio Troncoso's latest book, Our Lost Border, Essays on Life Amid the Narco Violence. I want to thank him for coming in today, as well as Ashton Harris, a student at the Bingham Academy, just wrapping up out in Independence. Thank you both for coming in. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.